Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. The UN Refugee Agency said Tuesday that it's concerned that some parts of an EU-Turkey proposal to stem the flow of refugees and migrants into Greece may violate international law. The UN Refugee Agency said aspects of the proposed agreement need to be clarified. However, it said it's concerned about any arrangement that involves the blanket return of all individuals from one country to another. EU leaders in Ankara said Tuesday they had reached a possible deal that would return thousands of migrants arriving in Greece from Turkey. The leaders are confident a full agreement can be reached at the summit next week. After months of disagreements and increased bickering among the 28 EU nations, the leader said they agreed to give Turkey more than $3 billion in additional funds to help with the nearly 3 million Syrian refugees it's hosting. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said Tuesday it turned down a meeting with U.S. President Barack Obama in Washington later this month because he wants to avoid interfering with the ongoing presidential primary elections. The White House said Monday that Israel had proposed a meeting for either March 17th or 18th with the Obama administration, agreeing to meet on one of those days. However, the National Security Council spokesman said they were surprised to learn via media reports that the prime minister had opted to cancel his visit. The U.S. government has added to the sanctions against the Lord's Resistance Army and the African rebel leader group Joseph Kony. The Treasury Department says financial sanctions announced Tuesday are in response to U.S. terrorist groups targeting civilians in the CAR. VOA News. Iran said Tuesday it had conducted ballistic missile tests at several sites across the country in order to show its deterrent power and readiness to confront threats. The tests come 2 months after the United States imposed new sanctions against 5 Iranian nationals and a network of companies with links to banned missile activity. Iran defended 2 previous missile tests last October as being a matter of national security after the U.S. and other Western powers said the launches violated a U.N. Security Council resolution. Bangladesh's highest court has rejected an appeal by a senior Islamist leader upholding his death sentence for war crimes committed during the country's 1971 war for independence with Pakistan. The Chief Justice S.K. Sinha announced a decision Tuesday against Mir Qasim Ali. The 63-year-old is a leader of the Jamaat-e-Islami Party and was convicted in 2014 on 8 charges that included the abduction of a young man and his killing in a torture cell. South Korea has imposed a new set of unilateral sanctions against North Korea in response to the regime's latest nuclear and ballistic missile tests. Under the sanctions announced Tuesday, Seoul blacklisted 40 North Koreans and 30 organizations involved in the North's nuclear development program, barring them from engaging in financial dealings in South Korea. Pakistan has urged Afghanistan's Taliban not to require conditions for direct peace talks with the Afghan government. Sartaj Aziz, the Pakistani Prime Minister's advisor on foreign affairs, spoke Tuesday at a news conference in Islamabad. He said the basic message to the Taliban would be that many of the preconditions that they're putting forward can come as a result of negotiation and not in advance, like prisoners' exchange and freedom of movement. The Taliban has insisted that futile and misleading negotiations would not bear any results. 2 years to the day after the Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 went missing, an interim statement issued about the aviation mystery contains no significant new information. The brief statement, read on Malaysian television by the chief of the International Investigation Team, says that to date, the MH370 wreckage has still not been found, despite the continuing search in the South Indian Ocean. China's trade activity declined more than expected last month due to weak demand in the global economy and reduced business activity during the Lunar New Year holidays. The Customs Bureau announced Tuesday that exports plunged 25.4% from the same period a year ago to $126.1 billion. China's trade surplus finished at $36.6 billion in February. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
The United Nations Refugee Agency says it is concerned some parts of the EU-Turkey proposal to stem the flow of refugees and migrants into Greece may be in violation of international law.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also at the Greek-Macedonian border, there's growing concern over a lack of hygiene and waterborne diseases, as well as migrants and refugees suffering from depression. More than a year after militia forces fired rockets at Libya's international airport, kidnappers are doing a brisk business on the city's outskirts. And we'll highlight some achievements of women on the continent as we celebrate International Women's Day. We'll have these stories plus sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny Young this week, music, and our feature report. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the UN Refugee Agency says it is concerned some parts of the EU-Turkey proposal to stem the flow of refugees and migrants into Greece may violate international law. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says some aspects of the proposed agreement between European Union heads of state and Turkey need to be clarified. But it says it is concerned about any arrangement that involves the blanket return of all individuals from one country to another. The European Union and Turkey have agreed to return all migrants arriving in Greece from Turkey. Under the plan, for every Syrian returned to Turkey, another Syrian in the country would be resettled in Europe. Turkey, which is hosting about 3 million Syrian refugees, will receive more than $3 billion in EU funding. UNHCR Refugee Coordinator for Europe, Vincent Costel, says he does not know the details of the plan, but says he worries it may lack safeguards to protect asylum seekers.
Collective expulsion of foreigners is prohibited under the European Convention of Human Rights, so an agreement that would be tantamount to a blanket return of any foreigners to a third country is not consistent with European law, is not consistent with international law.
Last year, more than 1 million refugees and migrants made the perilous journey across the Mediterranean Sea from Turkey to Europe. Most arrived in Greece. The Turkish Coast Guard is reportedly intercepting would-be migrants on an irregular basis in an effort to discourage human smugglers. Costel tells VOA he has no objection to interceptions in Turkish territorial waters, as long as those aboard are able to access protection.
We know that 91% of the people arriving in Greece are Afghans, Iraqis, and Syrians fleeing for their life, fleeing because of the conflict or fleeing because of the human rights violation in their country. They're not people that are looking for a better economic future. They're people that are fleeing those conflicts that are still unsolved today.
The UNHCR urges European leaders to ensure the plan includes proper legal safeguards for refugees before they meet next week to finalize the deal with Turkey. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. It's been raining a lot in recent days along the Greek-Macedonian border, and thousands of migrants and refugees are wet, cold, and hungry. The border has been opened only occasionally. Reporter Philip Warwick has been following developments at the border and the camp in the Greek town of Adomeni. Warwick says there's growing concern over a lack of hygiene and waterborne diseases, as well as migrants and refugees suffering from depression. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about conditions there.
The influx of refugees has been particularly acute in Idomeni, and the refugee bottleneck has now stands at about between 13,000 to 14,000. The camp is overwhelmed, and the conditions have grown increasingly squalid. The road that leads to the main camp, you have two fields on both sides. You have mud, you have puddles, not the best in conditions when you have tents in and around the area. In front of me, you have kids running around barefoot, some with shoes on, and families in their tents. So basically, it's pretty rough conditions at the moment.
Philip, does the camp have any type of shelter? It sounds like many of these people are just living out in the open.
back in November, December, you had the large tents that were built by MSF, Doctors Without Borders. They housed about 150 people. Now, when you had the mass make their way in January, February, they were very quickly sold out. But then you had people build tents around those. As that expanded, then you had people squat in the Greek countryside. So you had the local authorities and the local NGOs actually approach the local farmers to ask them if they could actually rent their fields for indefinitely, because obviously you still have refugees coming in on a daily basis. Not the same amount as you had before, but you still have a trickle coming in.
Philip, last week when we spoke, you had mentioned that they would occasionally open the Greek-Macedonian border and possibly let in several hundred people. What is the situation now regarding the border being open?
You don't have the same numbers that you had, say, last week and the week before that. And I think that is certainly something to do with the EU-Turkey summit that took place yesterday. Obviously, the Turkish leadership with EU leaders are looking for a solution to the matter, and they put the crossing on hold in terms of trying to find a solution there. Obviously, you can close the border gate, but at the end of the day, you have the refugees and the migrants who suffer. What I'd like to tell you is that the refugees themselves have little information from the authorities on both sides of the border, from the Greek police as well as the Macedonian police. Speaking to many of them, they feel that they're in limbo, and many are uncertain of their future. Also talking to NGO volunteers that work with the refugees, the volunteers are saying that speaking with the refugees and migrants, many of them have become tired and disillusioned when it comes to the situation itself. For example, when we're talking about food, that there are very long food queues here. An individual can easily wait 3 to 4 hours just to grab a sandwich, orange, and a bottle of water. Talking to a family a couple of days ago, they said this is the situation. We wake up in the morning, queue for hours, eat, sleep, and then wake up, and the process repeats itself.
You had mentioned that the numbers were pretty high at the camp, over 12, 13,000. Are people still coming to Idomeni?
There is a trickle, but in Greece we have around 15 hotspots. What they mean by hotspots is basically refugee camps, which are being built in and around the country. The refugees are still coming, ferrying from Turkey, ending up in Lesbos, are ending up in Athens, and then they're being transferred to these various camps. So we're not seeing the same numbers coming to Idomeni as they're being ferried and transferred to other camps, but you still have trickles of refugees coming in.
That's reporter Philip Warwick at the Greek-Macedonian border. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. More than a year after militia forces fired rockets at Libya's international airport, the former national capital has been evacuated by most foreign diplomats and thousands of foreign workers. Entrepreneurs have deserted the city and oil production has plummeted. However, kidnappers are doing a brisk business on the city's outskirts. VOA's David Arnold reports.
Despite more than 2 years of negotiations by UN envoys, the political divisions between Libya's east and west remain strong. While the U.S. and other foreign forces try to push back against the threat of Islamic State forces in other parts of the nation, not much happens in the once-thriving oil capital, says journalist Salah Sarar.
We don't have much foreigners who like conduct business. There are no foreign companies. There are no foreign workers after the revolution and the civil war. Most of them, they left the country. So only Libyans, not supported by the government. So that's why most of the goods are exported from neighboring countries. So we have no business in this country.
Sarar says security is good in the center of the city, but few will travel to Tripoli's outskirts, where armed gangs sometimes rule.
If you look at Tripoli, the capital itself, inside the city, the situation is normal. People are moving around. They can go to the coffee shops. They can go to the markets. People like women, they move around. But if you take the outskirts of Tripoli, sometimes there are some problems, like kind of kidnappings and some gangs, but not inside the city, but like in the outskirts of Tripoli. So people are afraid to move out. Especially in the night, they are subjected to the gangs. They take their money, they take their cars. Some people are subjected to kidnapping.
Among the multitude of tribal and regional militias that arose during the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi, a group of Islamists have formed a kind of Tripoli security apparatus that Sabar says is called the RADA.
There is police, which is not very much, and the government army, who are controlling the streets and the city, securing the people of the city. We also have the forces of deterrence, which are conducting everything in the city. People like the deterrence forces, which are helping the people in Tripoli. These are the forces of the government. They call Rada. These are controlling streets, also taking care of the people.
Tripoli is the capital of the western part of the country, and Benghazi and Tobruk are the seat of eastern rule. Although the parliament in Tobruk is known as the government recognized by the rest of the world, Sarar says Tripoli takes care of all national services, including the central bank and the pumping, sale, and distribution of oil, the mainstay of the national economy.
So we can say that, yes, there are two governments, there are two parliaments, one in the east and one in the west, but the services comes from the government of Tripoli. For example, regarding the oil production, it's controlled by the government of Tripoli, because before that division, it was in the hand of the NOC, which is controlled by Tripoli. And Central Bank, for example, is the main one in Tripoli. Also, the National Oil Corporation in Tripoli has the responsibility of delivering services to all cities in entire Libya, the cooking gas, the oil. And most of the world companies, they know the NOC of Tripoli. The NOC in the east, it's a new one. The Central Bank is a new one.
Both governments compete for control of the oil and banking industries, but the militias have crippled oil in much of Libya, so the nation's oil industry doesn't offer the promise of prosperity.
If you talk about producing oil in the country, it's decreased very much from production of 1.6 million barrels a day to 370,000 barrels a day. So it's very low, because many oil fields and harbors are closed now by the militia in this country.
Libya's salvation no longer depends on oil production. It requires the ability of competing political and military interests to share power and rebuild a broken country, and that's likely to take a long time. This is David Arnold, VOA, Washington, D.C.
Thank you, David. In related news, Tunisian security forces continue their search for gunmen who attacked the border town of Ben Guadain yesterday. It's believed some 50 attackers crossed the border from Libya. Authorities say 36 of them were killed and 7 were captured. Also, 7 civilians and 12 members of Tunisian security forces were killed and 14 others wounded. Authorities blame the attack on Islamic State militants. Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Well, today is International Women's Day, a day devoted by the UN and non-governmental organizations to celebrate women's political, economic, and social progress. Many such efforts are included in the 17 Sustainable Development Goals adopted by member countries of the United Nations. From Washington, reporter William Eagle looks at the importance of the goals in achieving gender equality and the empowerment of women.
The 17 SDGs, which end in 2030, include the unfinished business of the Millennium Development Goals, and add other areas such as coping with climate change, promoting clean water and sanitation, and promoting living standards, innovation, and economic growth. UN officials say the SDGs attempt to include the needs of marginalized groups the world over, including women. For example, Goal 11 supports sustainable cities and includes efforts to make urban areas safe for women. Diana Afuana is the Regional Director for West and Central Africa and also Acting Director for Eastern and Southern Africa for the group UN Women. She gave several examples where investments in public infrastructure, inclusion of women in politics, passing legislation that enhances women's rights, as well as implementing affirmative financing programs, have gone a long way in transforming the lives of women and, by extension, their families and the economy as a whole.
We have found through our Safe Cities program, when we sensitize policymakers, the mayors and the city planners, when we sensitize them to things as basic as better lighting, when we sensitize the security organs to provide security and safety, it ensures the security and the safety of our women and girls.
The SDGs also contain indicators that ensure that women have a role in disaster management and relief efforts. Afona stresses the importance of including women's views in all post-disaster and reconstruction efforts, including in camp management, which is usually left to men. In one instance, she says, a camp management team had not taken into account the fact that breastfeeding mothers need a special diet. She said water at the camp was running low, and mothers had problems nourishing themselves and their children.
The worst part of it was that the food that they were getting was maize and beans. Now, for a lactating mother, you actually need more than that. You need milk, you need porridge, you need, So after some days, the women were not able to lactate, and there was no water.
She says had women been included in the camp management team, the problem probably would have been identified earlier in the process. The SDGs also promote women's participation and leadership in politics. In some countries, UN Women has supported advocacy efforts for quotas. It has also trained women candidates before elections in parliamentary caucusing, confidence building, and debating skills so they can better advocate for pro-women legislation. UN Women has also supported the setting up of so-called women's situation rooms before, during, and after elections. Afuana says this has been done in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Senegal, Nigeria, and more recently in Uganda.
These situation rooms are actually a physical space with a 24-hour call center. Usually manned by youth volunteers, girls, women. And the women's situation rooms receive reports on a minute-by-minute basis from all districts and all counties that we've identified as hotspots.
The women's situation rooms comprise prominent women from different African countries who enjoy stature and moral authority. They meet with government officials, political parties, candidates for elections, as well as security organs, women's groups, and civil society. They also help to broker peace and consensus in deadlocks, preempt potential violence or conflict, and provide for the participation and safety of women voters and candidates. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
Thanks, Bill, for that report. And women make up the majority of farmers in Africa. A big percentage of urban households on the continent are led by women who are making decisions on their families' diets. Rural and urban women play a key role in farming and putting food on the table for their families. To improve the nutrition that their children are receiving, women are embracing the benefits of growing biofortified crops. Biofortified crops play a crucial role in feeding children during early periods of growth. Emily Mwale Banda is the assistant country manager for Harvest Plus in Zambia. She spoke with me about the vital role women play in fighting micronutrient deficiencies through a biofortification program initiated by Harvest Plus.
Women farmers are actually keen to have their household healthy, because if their families are not so healthy, they will not be as productive as they should be. So introduction of high micronutrient crops have actually been received with positive attitude by the women, and so they are participating in growing besides the other crops that they've been growing for their home consumption.
What are some of these crops?
In Zambia, they grow maize, beans, pumpkins, for both the fruit and the vegetable, the green leaves. Some of them also grow cotton, soybeans, cassava because of the volatile rain seasons that we have, and cassava is actually more resistant to drought than the maize. So most of the households now are also growing cassava, so that if the maize does not produce as expected, they would actually lean on cassava crop.
How important is it that women use biofortified crops as opposed to giving their children supplements?
In Zambia, which is also common in the rest of Africa, is that health centers are actually sparsely located. And some women in the most rural areas, they are unable to access the medical services where they can actually receive some supplements. And it's only the 6 months to 5 year old children that are able to access that assistance from the government. The rest of the children are actually dependent on what is grown and consumed in the house.
What role do women play in making decisions regarding using the biofortified crops?
A rural woman has a very big role in what is supposed to be consumed in the house, because when she learns of something that would actually improve the nutrition and health of the household, she actually extends her hand to grow it. Because rural women in Africa, most of them do not own land of their own, so they request for permission to be given a portion for them to grow the crop that will be actually good for the family. With the man, he can even decide to grow tobacco. He can decide to grow a cash crop which may not be so beneficial for the house. But the woman will try by all means to have something that would be beneficial to the household. The role a woman in the rural area plays in actually adopting into growing the biofortified crops is by actually linking up with fellow women. They learn the benefits that they are able to get from there and share with their husband, so that the husband can have a buy-in and accept that crop to be grown by them in their farms.
And how successful are they in doing this?
So far, where we have introduced the vitamin A orange maize in Zambia, it has been accepted everywhere, including men. They've actually accepted it. In other parts of Africa where we have the sweet potato, like Uganda, and some of it has been introduced in Zambia, women have also taken a big role in actually growing it, because it is a crop that is regularly eaten as a breakfast meal in houses.
And how important is it for the health of the child to be eating this particular biofortified crop?
It is very important, because more than 90% of Africa, for children who are under 5, they have high levels of deficiencies. And so introducing crops that are actually high in vitamins and minerals, it is helping a lot of women and their families to have access to crops that will be eaten regularly and improve their health in their homes.
That was Emily Mwale Banda, Assistant Country Manager for Harvest Plus in Zambia. She spoke with me from Lusaka. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss food and the rise of African cuisine with host Shaka Sali and his guests. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The UN Refugee Agency is concerned some parts of the EU-Turkey proposal to stem the flow of refugees and migrants into Greece may violate international law. More than a year after militia forces fired rockets at Libya's international airport, kidnappers are doing a brisk business on the city's outskirts. And African women farmers are growing more nutrient-rich crops. Coming up, we'll have music and our feature report. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And, of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in this week for Sonny Young. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim, it's football first.
All righty.
Thank you very much. And we begin in Zurich, Switzerland, where the second edition of the FIFA Women's Football and Leadership Conference concluded on Monday at the FIFA headquarters. FIFA's president Gianni Infantino, in his closing remarks, urged the football community to embrace further quotas to increase the number of women in decision-making roles in order to help secure the future of the game. FIFA's new reforms include obligations to promote and support women's football and women in football, and a requirement of at least one female representative per confederation to be elected to the new FIFA Council.
These meetings, these conferences like today are extremely, extremely important because it gives us the input that we need. And believe me, it is not just another conference. It is not just another meeting. It is not just another panel discussion. What has been discussed here, what has been said here, will be worked out, will be elaborated into some concrete proposals that will help us to move forward. I said it in my campaign, I can repeat it now, women football and women in football is a priority, has to be a priority for football. It is not part of the problem, that's right, it's part of the solution for the future of football. And we've always to remember, but we need to have targets, we need to have objectives, and we need to work on that. We need to work on having more women in the council we have already. An increase of 600%, that's fantastic. But it's not this. Of course it's not this. We have to look into all the bodies. It's a minimum of six. It must be more. In all the other committees, we have to look into increasing women representation. Is 30% the right target? If you say it, probably yes. Well, let's look into that. Let's analyze it. Let's put ambitious targets and let's see where we get to, and let's see what we can achieve. But we have to achieve something which is clear and which is significant and which makes a real difference. We have to develop the commercial side as well of women's football. The Women's World Cup is a great competition. It is a great competition which has a great potential, and we have to work on that as well. And if this means that at the beginning we have to invest some resources, then we will have to do that. We have to look at the clubs in terms of club licensing, in terms of club competitions. In UEFA, we started the Champions League when I was General Secretary. And it started slowly, and it's getting better and better and better. And we have to look into all of these things to see how we can improve the game. And we have to do it seriously. We have to allocate the right and the necessary resources to do that. But more than that, we have to allocate and put into it the necessary passion and commitment that is needed. You will have the passion and the commitment from my side. This, you can be sure. As I said, however, already in the introduction, alone I cannot do anything. I will need your help and your support to do the right thing. And I count on you for that, and I thank you for coming here today.
That was FIFA President Gianni Infantino speaking yesterday at the second FIFA Women's Football and Leadership Conference. The conference, titled Equality Through Reform, focused on three areas: women's football development, women in leadership, and reform. The FIFA Women's Football and Leadership Conference is an annual event that coincides with International Women's Day and seeks to provide a platform for open and honest debate about how to improve the organization's support for women in football. Now, for more sports news, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join the breaks. Mark Ouma, and Mark begins with cycling.
Rwanda will host the biannual 2018 African Continental Road Cycling Championship. The Rwanda Cycling Federation president, Aimable Bayingana, told the Kigali media on Monday. Bayingana says the Confederation of African Cycling confirmed Rwanda would stage the event during this year's championship, recently concluded in Casablanca, Morocco. Turning to athletics, Kenyan Cyprian Kotut clocked 1 hour and 1 minute to win the Paris Half Marathon in the French capital on Sunday. Fellow Kenyan Amos Kipruto was runner-up ahead of Ethiopian Asmerau Mengistu. Meanwhile, Ethiopian Dibaba Kuma prevailed in the women's race in 1 hour 9 minutes and 18 seconds, with Kenyan Pauline Wanjiku placed runner-up. In football, Egypt buried Libya under an avalanche of 8 goals without reply in their 2016 Women's Africa Cup of Nations qualifier played in Sousse, Tunisia on Sunday. Kenya got a bye to the next round following the withdrawal from the competition by their opponents at the Democratic Republic of Congo. In rugby, South Africa lies second in the overall standings after the sixth leg in the nine-leg IRB Sevens series that ended in Las Vegas, Nevada States in the United States of America on Sunday. South Africa has 86 points and are behind Fiji, who have 91, but ahead of the series defending champions New Zealand, who have 82 points. Kenya is 8th with 52 points, while Zimbabwe is 17th with 1 point. The next leg in the contest will be in Vancouver, Canada next weekend. Finally, in tennis, the two-week ITF Confederation of Africa Junior Tennis Championship gets underway in the South African capital, Tshwane, today, Tuesday. The contest features players in the under 16 and under 14 age groups.
That was Mark Ouma reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. In more African football news, the 2016 CAF Champions League, the 52nd edition of Africa's Premier Club Football Tournament, is underway. For updates on these championships, let's go back to Johannesburg and join our football guru, David Legg, for an update. Exciting league so far, David.
That's right, Douglas. We had one outstanding preliminary round fixture. What happened is there was a strike at Niamey Airport, and that prevented Niger hosting a couple of club matches. And it was a very close call for Wydad Casablanca of Morocco. They were the champions way back in 1992, and they're a strong side, and they were certainly big favourites to get past AS Douanes of Niger. Now, Wydad won the first leg 2-0, but in the return match, they were trailing 2-0, and the match was heading for a penalty shootout when, in stoppage time at the end of the game, the Moroccans pulled one goal back. So hard luck there for Douanes, winning the match 2-1, but being eliminated 3-2 on aggregate. So we can now look, Douglas, at an updated Champions League last 32 draw, and significantly now, the big guns enter the competition. You've got V-Club of DR Congo against Ferroviario of Mozambique, Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa against AC Leopards of Congo Brazzaville, Wari Wolves of Nigeria against Al-Marek of Sudan, Etoile of Congo against Anton Satif of Algeria, Wydad Casablanca of Morocco, they play Knats of Madagascar. St. George of Ethiopia play TP Mazembe of DR Congo, who are the defending champions. And Yimba of Nigeria play Vitalo of Burundi. Koribga of Morocco play Etoile Sahel of Tunisia. Stade Malien of Mali play Cotton Spore of Cameroon. Zesco of Zambia are up against Horoya of Guinea. APR of Rwanda against Young Africans of Tanzania, a spicy East African derby, that one. Lebolo of Angola against Al Ahly of Egypt. Kaiser Chiefs of South Africa face ASEC Mimosas of Ivory Coast. Al-Ahli Tripoli of Libya play Al-Hilal of Sudan. Union Douala of Cameroon are up against the Zamalek of Egypt. And Club Africain of Tunisia play Mouloudia Bejaia of Algeria. Now, normally, Douglas, there's a two-week break between the first and second legs, but on this occasion, there's just a one-week break. What happens is that the first legs will be played this coming weekend, March 11, 12, and 13, and the return matches will be played the following weekend, March 18, 19, and 20. And just some statistics around that last 32 draw, there are 11 former champions in the field. Zambia are bidding to, for the third time, which would be a record for the CAF Champions League, successfully defend a title. They won it in 67 and 68 when it was known as the African Cup of Champion Clubs. They won it again in 2009 and 2010. And now, having won it in 2015, they're seeking yet another double by winning it again in 2016. At the moment, Mazembe share the title for doubles, so to speak, with Al Ahly, the great Egyptian club. They won it in 2005 and 2006, and again in 2012 and 2013. The most appearances, though, is not by Al Ahly. What we had, Douglas, recently on the Sunny Side of Sport was a quiz, and we posed the question, which club has entered the CAF Champions League on the most occasions, and most people plumbed for Al Ahly, who have entered it 27 times. But the record, in fact, is held with 29 appearances by Al Hilal of Sudan. And in third place are ASEC Mimosas of the Ivory Coast. They've made 25 appearances. There's only one club making their debut this year who are in the last 32 round of the competition, and that's Mouloudia Bejaia of Algeria, not to be confused with a team that competed in the competition a few years ago, also from Bejaia. They were JSM Bejaia, a different club.
That was our African football guru, David Legg, in Johannesburg. Thanks much, David.
You ask for it and we answer it. The Sunny Side of Sports is expanding our showtime on VOA Africa.
In many countries, preparations for the Rio 2016 Olympics are in full gear. But how is the host country coping as they gear up for to host this major sports event? Luis Piazzi reports from Rio.
Sport Olympic greetings, Douglas. The last 4.5 legs to go for the Olympics in Rio are already hacked enough indeed. August is just around the corner, and a lot of promised and needed implementations is still either halfway built or even just on paper. From light vehicles train to subway stations, water station and marina, to name just a few, are still incomplete and to blame on delays a recycling loop. Contractors delay constructions, their contracts are concealed by the mayor, and until the actual project is reassigned to a brand new contractor, the delay comes back in the news. One same issue always in the picture is the budget for those projects and the decision-making involving high-profile bodies, the so-called organizing committee and the external governance, the late one being the Games Council, formed by the mayor of Rio, governor of Rio, being the head, the very president of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff, facing a risk of impeachment because of a public money used in her campaign while she was running for the presidency. As the worldwide breaking news last Friday was the former Brazilian President Lula taken in custody for questioning by police and his house raided as part of a major fraud inquiry into the state oil company Petrobras and other allegedly illicit acts, the contenders and commentators are asking how much it would add to all troubles the Olympic Games face to actually kick off. Until then, remain surfing around as the major issues the pollution of the Guanabara Bay for sailing races. It will still filthy by August. All the experts agree publicly with that. Zika is not a lesser threat, to the contrary. And the mobility around the city of Rio chaotic and dangerous, being the security one of the major concerns. So much that after the Australian committee publicly prohibited their athletes to walk anywhere near favelas, it became a volley of verbal friction between officials from Brazil and Australia. On the sports side of Olympics, a good news came up in the last 2 days when the IOC declared that a team made up exclusively of refugees is set to compete under the Olympic flag in Rio. Among 40 athletes, female and male, pre-selected, the International Olympic Committee says as many as 10 would get the go-ahead to take part at the Games as the team of refugee Olympic athletes, said the IOC president Thomas Bach. In contention are swimmers, runners, cyclists, judokas, like the Congoleses Popole Mizenga and Yolande Mabika, exiled in Brazil 3 years so far, currently living in a favela in Rio. I am Luis Piazzi for the Sunny Side of Sports.
Thank you, Luis. Finally, Mo Farah has been confirmed in Great Britain's team to compete at the 2016 IAAF World Half Marathon Championships in Cardiff. The 32-year-old double Olympic and five-time world track champion is European half marathon record holder and won the 2014 Great North Run. Kenya's Geoffrey Chipsang will defend his world title in Cardiff. Farah's world half marathon debut will form part of his Olympic build-up as he prepares to defend his 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters titles in Rio this summer. The 23-year-old Kenyan has told the media he's going to Cardiff to break the world record of 13.1 miles, which currently stands at 58.23 and was set up by Eritrean Tesfayak Tadese in 2010 in Lisbon. Organizers say the event hopes to attract 25,000 runners. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Mpuga. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Douglas, he's going to have an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, the failure to offer attractive conditions for health professionals in Zimbabwe has left the country with a shortage of speech therapists who play a critical role in linking medical professionals with clients. First, here's a song by Artists for Haiti, We Are the World.
Comes a time when we hit a certain call, when the world must come together as one. There are people dying.
Oh, when it's time to lend a hand to life,
the greatest gift of all.
We can't go on pretending day by day
that someone somehow will soon make a change.
We are all a part of God's great big family, and the true, you know, love is all we need.
We are the world. We are the children. We are the ones who make a way.
There's a choice we're making. We're saving our own lives. It's true, we'll make a better day, just you and me.
So their cries for help will not be in vain.
We can't let them suffer. No, we cannot turn away.
Right now, they need a helping hand.
No, someone like.
just believe there's no way we can fall.
Artists for Haiti, we are the world. Well, in Zimbabwe, the failure to offer attractive conditions of service for health professionals has resulted in lack of specialists in most state-owned hospitals. They include speech therapists, who play a crucial role in linking medical professionals with clients. VOA correspondent Patricia Mudadigwa reports.
Speaking at a health workshop on the visual and hearing impaired held in Harare, Michele Angelet, country representative of Christian Blind Mission, said the majority of poor people in Zimbabwe had no access to speech therapists.
Right now, there is not a single speech therapist working in public service in Zimbabwe. We as CBM, we are trying to support the establishment of Bachelor of Sciences in Speech Therapy and Audiology at the University of Zimbabwe. We are establishing speech therapy services at Harare Children's Hospital. The point is, you see, we are trying as much as possible to complement, but what you can do as parliamentarians, you can advocate whenever budget times come, because the freezing of the posts right now that is forced, given the economic situation, is hurting the service provision.
This was confirmed by Permanent Secretary in the Ministry of Health and Child Care, Dr. Gerald Gwinji, who told the same workshop that the government does not have money to pay salaries of these specialists.
These are very celebrable people. As soon as you train them and you don't pay them properly, they go. It's not an issue of us not training. It's an issue of us failing to retain them.
Ruth Labode, chairperson of the Parliamentary Committee on Health and Child Care, said adoption of a disability policy will compel the government to ensure the presence of specialist medical personnel at public hospitals.
And yet the issue is the policy document, and the policy document 10 years has been in the ministry.
Gwinji concurred, adding that there was need for Zimbabwe to urgently adopt a disability policy. He said work on the policy had commenced.
Consultations were done, and the primary ministry is now finalizing the issues around validation on this policy.
Some people living with disabilities who attended the workshops bemoan the failure by government to meaningfully invest in the health sector to lower skilled medical personnel and specialists. According to a disability activist, Barbara Nyangairi, speech therapists play a critical role in people's lives, including those with problems related to their senses.
Speech therapy makes use of residual senses. And for those that are able to acquire some speech, it is important for you to be able to provide speech therapy for them so that they are then able to use those residual senses more effectively.
However, Nyangairi said while a disability policy is important in Zimbabwe, what is more critical for the country's implementation of such policies?
Zimbabwe already has a lot of good policies. A disability policy would provide a holistic sum of all the things that are provided for within our legal framework in order to operationalize them. So I think that the challenge that we face as Zimbabwe is implementation. A lot of things die at the implementation stage. And so having a policy which is good on paper, but without the political will to implement that particular policy, will not be of much use to people with disabilities.
According to health experts, speech-language pathologists, sometimes called speech therapists, assess, diagnose, treat, and help to prevent communication and swallowing disorders in patients. Speech, language, and swallowing disorders result from a variety of causes such as a stroke, brain injury, hearing loss, developmental delay, Parkinson's disease, a cleft lip or palate, and autism. This is Patricia Mdadigwa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
March 8th is International Women's Day, celebrated by the United Nations since 1975 and adopted by a UN resolution in 1977 as United Nations Day for Women's Rights and International Peace. It is a day to reflect on women's progress, call for further change, and acknowledge the courage and determination of women working for gender equality around the world. It is also an opportunity to raise awareness about the struggles of women and girls the world over. Struggles for education, for equality before the law, for access to basic services that men take for granted, such as access to banking or training, and adult education. In too many cases, women struggle for basic respect, and in the worst cases, they struggle to be seen not as the property of anyone, but as a free and independent person. The fact is that although women and girls have made great strides in the past 41 years, they still have a long way to go. Nowhere in the world can women claim to have all the same rights and opportunities as men. The majority of the world's poorest people are women, and their work is less valued. They receive 30-40% less pay than men for doing the same work. Their lack of economic power sometimes translates to powerlessness in other aspects of their lives as well, where they disproportionately suffer from gender-based violence. That is why this year's theme is Planet 50-50 by 2030, Step It Up for Gender Equality. A part of the United Nations 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, it is an all-out push to implement a number of United Nations commitments on gender equality, women's empowerment, and women's human rights. This includes goals such as ending all forms of discrimination against women and girls everywhere, eliminating all forms of violence against women and girls, stopping all practices specifically harmful to girls, such as child, early and forced marriage, and female genital mutilation, and ensuring that all girls and boys receive a quality primary and secondary education. Any society hoping to flourish must begin by empowering its women and by promoting for them the same rights that men already enjoy. On International Women's Day, we celebrate and honor women and girls and commit ourselves to making the world a place where women and girls are not excluded or marginalized, but are free to realize their full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Madou discusses how new technology can be utilized effectively in disease surveillance such as Zika and Ebola. Our guest is Graham Dodge, CEO of Sick Weather, a U.S.-based disease surveillance company. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202 619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.